Would you open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 24, and we're starting in verse 15. For the past few weeks now, we've been slowly making our way through the challenging and controversial words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 24. And I say controversial because Jesus is speaking words of prophecy here. And on no point have good men so entirely disagreed as on the interpretation of prophecy, as J.C. Ryle has said. Now, it's true, there are New Testament scholars out there who don't even believe prophecy is a real thing. They don't believe in the supernatural, which makes it funny that they're New Testament scholars, but they exist. And so some would insist that this chapter of Matthew could only have been written after the fact, that it could only have been written after the destruction of Jerusalem, that the words we're studying today were written sometime after AD 70. But as one commentator put it, if anyone were to write something after the fall of Jerusalem and try to make it look like prophecy, this isn't how they do it, he says. Instead, you'd have real specific stuff, and you'd make it look like Jesus just nailed it down to the day and the hour and the direction the armies came from and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But he says that's not what you have here. You've got general stuff, and I think he's right. I think he's right. I think that's a great indication that this was written, among other things, indications that this was written before the fall of Jerusalem. And that's one reason it's, because this is more general, that's one reason it's so much harder for interpreters to agree on what's being pointed to here and when. Well, having said that, if we really were going to simplify things in chapter 24, if we were really going to boil down all the controversial ways of understanding this chapter, we'd have to say there are really three broad ways people tend to interpret what we find in Matthew 24. There are basically three major perspectives on this chapter. The first two perspectives hold to one of two extremes. So the first perspective we might call the dispensationalist or futurist view. This view would be that it says that all the events that Jesus talks about in Matthew chapter 24 are events that are still to take place in the future, all of them. They're still out there somewhere. They haven't happened yet. So that's one extreme view. The second perspective, which holds to the opposite extreme, is sometimes called the preterist or full preterist view. The word preterism comes from the Latin praetor, meaning past. So this would be the view that says all of Matthew 24 has been fulfilled already. It's all in the past. In other words, there are no more prophecies in this chapter left to be fulfilled today or in the future. And then there's a third major perspective about the prophecies of Matthew 24. It's basically a middle ground position, which is to say those who don't hold to either of the two extreme positions believe that some of Matthew 24 has already been fulfilled in the past, and some of Matthew 24 has yet to be fulfilled in the future. And the trick of interpretation comes down to knowing where to draw that line. In other words, to know where Jesus is answering and predicting which thing, whether he's talking about the first question of the disciples or the second question. And so there's lots of differences even within that third middle position. Many in this position even hold that it's possible that there are some events, let's just say, for instance, like the Great Tribulation, which might have more than one fulfillment in history, sort of a smaller scale fulfillment at one time, as well as a larger scale fulfillment at a future time. So there's lots of different ways people come at this. Well, as I've already told you, I'm holding to a middle ground position. So that means I primarily believe that some of what we see predicted in chapter 24 has already been fulfilled long ago, and that some of what's been predicted is still in our future. It's still to come. And I'm holding that what's already been fulfilled are the prophecies that had to do primarily with the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in AD 70 by the armies of Rome. The disciples first asked Jesus, when will these things be? And I've told you, I believe Jesus is answering that first question in verses 4 through verse 35. If you want to make a little mark in your Bible there, so you can start asking questions, that's a good idea. And the most specific thing he's predicted so far Jesus has predicted so far in answering that first question is that this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end of the temple will come, we said last week. And that's exactly what we saw confirmed, I think, last week. I hope I made a reasonable case for that last week. We saw last week that in AD 62, for example, only 29 years after Jesus says these words, the Apostle Paul was able to write in a letter to Jewish and Gentile Christians at the church of Colossae that the gospel which had come to them had indeed already been proclaimed in the whole world, he says, in all creation under heaven, he says, by which he means all the inhabited world around the Mediterranean, all the inhabited world of the Roman Empire. And we know that about 5 years after writing that, the temple was destroyed by the armies of Rome, and most of Jerusalem along with it. This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. That's where we were last week. And today we're going to see that it's this coming end, that this coming threat that prompts Jesus to speak now about three events his disciples can't miss. They can't miss these events. And the first coming event they can't miss is that devastating pollution is coming. Last week, we slowed way down. We walked through one verse, verse 14. But today, we've got to cover 13 verses in the time we have. So hold on to something. We're going to really move along here. So we're going to jump right in. Let's look at verses 15 and 16. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, Jesus says. The word so that starts this sentence, it's a connecting word that links verse 14 and verse 15. Jesus is saying, they'll know the end spoken of in verse 14 is coming when they see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, something the prophet Daniel prophesied about almost 500 years earlier. In the words of R.T. France, that phrase, kind of a strange phrase, the abomination of desolation, is a combination of the ideas of disgust or pollution and the ideas of destruction or leaving deserted, kind of put together, those ideas. And so first, abomination here is literally a revolting word. I remember getting bad food poisoning at a restaurant once, and for about a year after that, all I had to do was drive by the place. I didn't have to eat it. I didn't have to go in there. I didn't have to smell anything. I just had to drive by that place and or even think about it, and I would feel revolted. The association with the food poisoning made me feel waves of nausea and revulsion. It was like the place was tainted or polluted, and it hadn't just polluted my stomach, but my mind too. Except in this case, instead of food or a restaurant, what's at the source of the revulsion here is something morally tainted. Something morally tainted. The word abomination carries the sense of an object that causes moral nausea or loathing, especially in the sight of God. And so it denotes anything in which estrangement from God manifests itself, writes Marvin Vincent. You know, for a Jew in Jesus' day, maybe a smaller example of this, of an abomination, might look like another Jew openly eating unclean animals or setting up an idol in his house. For us, in our day, this might look like a church flying a rainbow flag on its building or on its website. It would be an abomination to God. Now, to be clear, not because of the people that the rainbow now represents, but because of the sin and because of the poisoning of God's created order that flag now represents. It's become a sickening sign of moral defiance against God and an estrangement from God, and it would be made worse for being displayed at a place where the exact opposite message was supposed to be proclaimed. It would be a nauseating moral stench to God. But in the case of our text, the revolting moral abomination in question isn't going to be some individual act of defiance, like like some idol set up in a Jewish home or even in some synagogue out in the countryside. No, it's going to be a high-profile kind of abomination in that it will be standing, it will be set up in the holy place itself, Jesus says. He's talking about the temple, the place where the Holy One of Israel is supposed to dwell and meet with his people. This sickening sign of moral defiance and estrangement from God is going to be made so much worse because of where it will be made to stand, in the place where God himself is supposed to sit enthroned and worshiped by his people. And so it's not just some common abomination being spoken of here. It's one so significant and so appalling that it will come with desolation. And that's a word that carries with it the idea of God's judgment. If you remember, it reminds us of some of Jesus' last words to the scribes and to the Pharisees in the temple back in chapter 23. He said, "See, your house is left to you desolate," he said, "left deserted and empty and ready for judgment." And I think he was pointing to the same thing there that he's pointing to here. It's an abomination that will serve as part of God's judgment on this people who have rejected his son. They would not receive his precious son, and so now God will not prevent the stones of their precious temple from being defiled and torn down. It's an abomination that will empty out the temple of sacrifices and of people. It's an abomination. It's a moral pollution that will bring desecration, destruction, and desertion, that will ultimately bring total devastation down on the temple and down on the city and down on the people who live there. That's what he says. And so, let the reader understand, Jesus says at the end of verse 15. This seems to mean, let whoever reads Daniel understand. Well, understand what? Understand, I think, what Daniel has prophesied about in Daniel chapter 9 and Daniel chapter 11, and we can't go into too much of that. We're going to go into some. But I think what he's saying is, let the reader understand that what Daniel has prophesied about there in chapters 9 and 11, using these same words about abomination and desolation, is what they're to expect to see some fulfillment of in their lifetime. It's going to be that unmissable. Well, what has Daniel prophesied in those chapters? Well, in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, we have what someone has called a prophetic clock. It's a prophecy about a sort of countdown that will begin the moment the decree is given for the exiles to return home from Persia to rebuild Jerusalem. And that decree is given by King Artaxerxes in 444 BC. The angel Gabriel then tells Daniel how many years will pass from that point until the Messiah will come and be cut off, he says, will be killed. And the numbers seem to point to 476 years after the decree of Artaxerxes, which ends up landing right at AD 33, the very year Jesus is speaking in our text and the very year he is cut off, the very year he is crucified. After that, Daniel says, the city and the sanctuary will be destroyed. He also says there will be an end made of sacrifice and offering. Then he says, on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate. Scholars have many opinions about what exactly the abomination of desolation is, writes R.C. Sproul. But many agree that Daniel was prophesying some kind of pagan desecration of the temple. And I agree. I think he's exactly right. Now, for the sake of fairness, really quick, there are many others who believe the abomination of desolation has more to do with a person than with an event or with an act. They wouldn't say it's completely separate, but they say it has more to do with a person. They believe it's a reference more to the Antichrist. And I wish we could spend more time to look at that today, but we don't have that time. I'm trying to rush us along, and that's okay because I still think at this point, Jesus is most specifically referring to what was described as some kind of pagan desecration of the temple. A later verse in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31, seems to point to this meaning as well. It says there, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. Now, it's important to note that in Jesus' day, Jewish scholars believed something like this had already happened in Israel's more recent past, by which I mean about 200 years earlier, in 168 BC. At that time, the ruler of the Seleucid Empire, Antiochus Epiphanes, had conquered Jerusalem. And when he did so, he put up a pagan altar in the temple. He even sacrificed a pig there, according to the historian Josephus, which of course, that was seen as a horrifying desecration to the Jews. Horrifying. In fact, the Jews in Jesus' day even referred to that act by these same words found in Daniel chapter 9 and Daniel 11. They used this same phrase to describe it, abomination of desolation. So something like this had already happened in the recent past. The thing is, here in our text, Jesus is speaking of something still to come. He's not talking about something in the past, he's talking about something still to come. Something that will apparently echo and repeat the sacrilege of that day in the recent past in an unmissable way. It will be an event made so recognizable by Daniel's prophecy, and so familiar because of recent events in history that they can't miss it. They can't miss it. Well, as we look back from our vantage point today, what could that event have been? Again, here there's no shortage of theories that I can't go into now, but I'm convinced that the strongest case is that the event Jesus is pointing to took place when the Roman armies, under Titus, finally broke through Jerusalem's defenses in AD 70 and eventually made their way into the temple itself. Imagine the scene. Gentile soldiers walking freely on the Temple Mount, even into the holy place, pillaging, raping, killing as they go. They don't even remove their muddy, bloody sandals as they stand on holy ground the way Moses did. No, they tromp into the holy place with no regard for God. And we know they went into the holy place. We know because, this is amazing to me, we have evidence in the form of a sculpture we can still see on the Arch of Titus in Rome. It's still there. You can go see it. You can see this picture that celebrates this victory over Jerusalem. This arch was erected in AD 81, like just over 10 years after the victory, to celebrate it. And that sculpture shows Titus and his men parading the golden menorah from the temple, parading it, and the table of the showbread that once stood in the holy place through the streets of Rome. Items no Gentile was ever supposed to see, much less touch. And I'll tell you, just seeing the image as a Christian, I'm not even a Jew, and seeing that image in that sculpture was deeply offensive. Can you imagine being a Jew and having to watch those events in person? And as they fight and pillage and march their way into the Temple Mount, they also carry and they raise up their military standards, their legion insignias and banners that are hung on long staffs, long poles, that are covered in figurines of eagles and the image of the emperor and the signs of the zodiac that the Jews rightly saw as idolatrous. Josephus even says Roman soldiers offered sacrifices to their standards in the temple courts. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. If the prediction here is that the first event they can't miss is the coming pollution and devastation of the temple, the application for the disciples and all those in Judea is now found in verse 16. When you see it coming, flee with urgency. Flee with urgency. And here we come to one of the main objections to this idea that the abomination of desolation spoken of by Jesus was a reference to the Roman soldiers and their defiling, idolatrous activities in the holy place. Some people they have a problem with that theory, and this is the main reason they have a problem with that theory. They say, if Jesus is saying they should look for this, this desecration of the temple, as the sign to flee out of Jerusalem, by then wouldn't it be too late? You know, a little late now. They're in the city. They're surrounding the city. They're killing people. Isn't it too late to escape? And how would the people in Judea, those who aren't even in the city itself, be able to see this act and know to flee? Well, I think the most satisfying answer to this objection is found in the parallel passage to our text that's found in Luke's gospel. Because there in Luke chapter 21, this is the description of what the disciples and those in Judea are to look for. Luke says this, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it." Well, you might wonder, how does that help us? How does that help us? Well, I think it helps by shedding light on what's actually being said in Matthew. In other words, I don't think Jesus is saying they have to wait around to actually see the inevitable happen. I think he's saying that when they see the armies of Rome marching across the countryside and approaching the city and beginning to surround it, they should at that point see and understand from Daniel and from history. In other words, they should recognize the pattern that's unfolding, and they should understand the nature of the devastating pollution that's coming. And they should get out of Dodge while they can. They should get out before the noose is fully closed, as one person has said. And now, verses 17 and 18 serve to illustrate the urgency they're to flee with. How quickly should they leave? Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in the house, Jesus says, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. Why are these significant illustrations? Most Jewish homes, you remember, were constructed with flat rooftops on which they either built an extra upper room or which was left open to enjoy the cool breezes in the evenings. Sometimes they put a little canopy up there. And the access to the rooftops didn't, you know, they didn't have like an internal staircase that came up to that roof. They had to access that roof from the exterior of the house. And so the idea is getting out of town is so urgent that if they get word that the armies of Rome are beginning to surround Jerusalem, they don't have time to even go down the outer staircase and go into their house to pack a bag. Some scholars have even taken this warning to mean that they don't even have time to get down their own staircase to flee at all, but that Jesus is urging them to begin fleeing instead by leaping from housetop to housetop, like in a movie. Like, don't even go down. Just go from housetop to housetop. Get out. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak, Jesus says. Again, you have this picture of incredible urgency. Here you are, you're working out in the fields, you're sweaty, you're dirty. And the idea is if that's what you're doing when you get the news about these encircling armies, don't run back home first for a change of clothes. Don't go back home for a shower before you flee. No, in fact, don't even go back to the other side of your field if that's where you left your cloak because it was getting too hot. That cloak that's so important that it doubles as your sleeping bag at night. No, just leave it and run. Flee to the mountains, he says. Flee to the mountains. And that's exactly what history seems to indicate the Christians in Jerusalem and Judea did. As the Roman armies approached, Titus sent three legions to the western side of the city and a fourth legion to the Mount of Olives to the east of the city. And when the Christians looked out and saw the legions coming, they seemed to have remembered Jesus' words here. As James White puts it, they looked out and said, 1 + 1 = run, and they were out of there. They were out of there. And whether they actually fled to the city of Pella and the foothills, as some claim, or to some other mountainous region, we're not sure. But what we do know for sure is that they didn't flee back into the city walls for refuge, like the normal strategy called for when large armies approached you. And as a result, according to the church historian Eusebius, almost no Christians died in Jerusalem in AD 70 because they fled in obedience to this prophecy. I think that's amazing. Today in our text, Jesus speaks about three events his disciples can't miss. The first event they can't miss is that devastating pollution is coming. And now the second event he says they can't miss is that great tribulation is coming. Great tribulation. Look now at verses 19 through 21. And alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now we hear Jesus say a word we've learned to dread in recent months. He says the word, woe. He says, woe. Woe to those women, he says. Except here, in this context, that word isn't spoken in a way of condemnation, like with the Pharisees. That was a different kind of woe. Instead, Jesus says it as an expression of sympathy, which is why most versions have it translated as alas, alas for those women. Why does Jesus say that? Well, here Jesus is still talking about those fleeing as refugees from Jerusalem and Judea in those days as the armies of Rome approach. Except his concern now is that the conditions for those fleeing might not be filled with extra difficulties that further hinder them from escaping this coming great tribulation. And what are the extra difficult conditions Jesus mentions here with concern? The first condition he's concerned about is pregnancy for women or those with infants that need nursing. He says, alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. And aren't the reasons obvious why he would have concern for them? These are the kinds of refugees who, as Leon Morris puts it, could not leave their burdens behind as the men could, right? Different kind of burden. They couldn't leave these burdens behind. And so these are the kinds of refugees who, as they flee, will be forced to move slower than everyone else. And so for these reasons, they represent the most vulnerable members of the population, those most likely to get stuck behind the walls and suffer. Alas for those women, Jesus says. His first concern is for the extra difficulty pregnancy and nursing children will add to the speed of the flight. And now his second concern is for the extra difficulty that winter and the Sabbath will add to the safety of the flight. How do these last two conditions pose extra difficulties for Jewish Christians? Well, the weather is cold in the winter months, believe it or not, over there in Judea, and extra water tends to wash out roads that people are fleeing on and soften up mud. Those are dangerous travel conditions with an army at your heels. And what about the Sabbath? That seems a little strange. Why would having to flee on that particular day be less safe for Jewish Christians than on a Monday or on a Thursday, do you think? Well, I'll tell you, again, I read lots of explanations about this. Why does he mention the Sabbath? I think the one that makes the most sense to me is this one. It would be less safe because as the only ones who no longer hold to the unbiblical traditions of the elders that limit a Sabbath day's journey to less than 1 mile, Jewish Christians would be the only ones on the road. What does that mean? That means they'd be extra easy targets for the Romans to pick off. That makes sense to me. If the prediction here is that the second event they can't miss is the coming of great tribulation, the application for the disciples and all those in Judea is found now in verse 20. When you see it coming, pray with fervency. Pray with fervency. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. And I'm saying they can't miss this because Jesus seems to single out the suffering of this time period as something uniquely awful, doesn't he? For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world, he says, until now. No, and never will be, Jesus says. Now, it's certainly possible that this prophecy about great tribulation, like many other things in chapter 24, might have some sort of double fulfillment that applies on a smaller scale to Jerusalem in AD 70, but also on a bigger scale, you know, to other future time events. And I'm sure that's possible, and I understand why people hold to that, but because I think it's easy to hear the severe language of Jesus here and wonder how it could really apply to the siege and eventual fall of a single city. You know, it's like, man, we've seen lots of bad things in the world. How could this be the worst to that point and the worst to ever come? And so maybe it's because, as R.T. France puts it, Jesus is just using the hyperbolic language of apocalyptic. In other words, many Old Testament prophecies use exaggerated end-time language to describe the acts of God's judgment in history. And so maybe that explains the language. Jesus is just exaggerating for effect or to point to something worse that's still to come that this event foreshadows. So maybe that's what it is. Or maybe we struggle to believe these words could really apply to the siege and destruction and fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 because we weren't there. We weren't there. But the Jewish historian Josephus was there. He was supposed to be a mediator for the Romans, but when negotiations failed, he became an eyewitness to the siege and the aftermath. And he seems to indicate with his writings that the words of Jesus here are no exaggeration at all, that things were that awful. I want to read you just a couple excerpts from his War of the Jews, book 6, that talk about some of the things that he witnessed. But when they went in numbers into the lanes of the city, he's talking about the Romans, when they broke through into Jerusalem, with their swords drawn, they slew those who they overtook without mercy and set fire to the houses whither the Jews were fled and burnt every soul in them and laid waste a great many of the rest. And when they were come to the houses to plunder them, they found in them entire families of dead men and the upper rooms full of dead corpses, that is, of such as died by the famine. They then stood in a horror at this sight and went out without touching anything. But although they had this commiseration for such as were destroyed in that manner, yet had they not the same for those who were still alive, but they ran everyone through whom they met with and obstructed the very lanes with the dead bodies and made the whole city run down with blood to such a degree indeed that the fire of many of the houses was quenched with these men's blood. The Temple Mount compound was the last part of the city to fall. Josephus writes, as the legions charged in, neither persuasion nor threat could check their impetuosity. Passion alone was in command. As they neared the sanctuary, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's commands and urged the men in front to throw in more firebrands. The partisans were no longer in a position to help. Everywhere was slaughter and flight. Most of the victims were peaceful citizens, weak and unarmed, butchered wherever they were caught. Round the altar, the heaps of corpses grew higher and higher, while down the sanctuary steps poured a river of blood, and the bodies of those killed at the top slithered to the bottom. Together with those whom they had orders to slay, they slew the aged and the infirm. But for those that were in their flourishing age and who might be useful to them, they drove them together into the temple and shut them up within the walls of the court of the women, over which Caesar set one of his freedmen named Fronto. So this Fronto slew all those that had been seditious and robbers, who were impeached by one another, but of the young men he chose out the tallest and most beautiful and reserved them for the triumph, that was the march through Rome. And as for the rest of the multitude that were above 17 years old, he put them into bonds and sent them to the Egyptian mines. Titus also sent a great number into the provinces as a present to them, that they might be destroyed upon their theaters by the sword and by the wild beasts. But those that were under 17 years of age were sold for slaves. Now, as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained none to be the objects of their fury, for they would not have spared any had there remained any other work to be done, Titus gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as they were of the greatest eminence. But for all the rest of the wall surrounding Jerusalem, it was so thoroughly laid, even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation, that there was left nothing to make those that came thither believe Jerusalem had ever been inhabited. Josephus goes on to record that 1.1 million people were killed in total during the siege. 1.1 million in a 5-month period. That about 97,000 were enslaved and that roughly 40,000 individuals survived. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, Jesus says now, no human being would be saved. This last statement from Jesus in verse 22 seems to line up perfectly with both the facts on the ground at the siege, as well as with an astonishing admission made by Titus himself. The facts on the ground were that the siege didn't last as long as expected. They came to an end. The siege came to an end after only about 5 months. That may sound like a long time to you, but it was a lot shorter than some sieges and shorter than they expected. This was due in part to the multiple thousands of, and this is just so sad, multiple thousands of extra pilgrims who had come to Jerusalem for the Passover right before the siege. Titus and the armies of Rome let them enter and did not let them leave. This had dramatically sped up the loss of food supply, sped up the starvation within the city. So that's one reason it went so quickly. But still, Titus was still so stunned at the swift victory that Josephus records him saying these words. And I think these are amazing words. He says this: "We have certainly had God for our assistant in this war. And it was no other than God who ejected the Jews out of these fortifications. For what could the hands of men or any machines do towards overthrowing these towers?" He acknowledges that God is judging Jerusalem. And his words line up perfectly with the divine agency that seems to be indicated by the passive verb here. In other words, those days were cut short by an outside power. We're saying this verse seems to be giving the credit for the shortened suffering to the divine purpose of God. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved, Jesus says. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Who are the elect that Jesus speaks of here? What does that word even mean? That word, elect, means chosen or picked out. And in this context, it refers to God's chosen people. Now here, I think we're used to assuming that the group called God's chosen people refers only to Jews. But I believe in this context of judgment that Jesus is saying it's a designation that applies both narrower and broader than that. Narrower first, because clearly not all the Jews in Jerusalem will be saved by the merciful shortening of the siege, right? Many of them die. They will not be saved. And so there seems to be a sense that the chosen ones Jesus refers to here are an even smaller group of Jews from within the larger group of Jews in Jerusalem. They are those who will eventually believe in Jesus and become Christians. What this tells us is that there will be Jewish men and women in Jerusalem during this siege who will survive the siege who weren't Christians before the siege. Remember, most of the Jewish Christians have already left. They've already fled before the siege came. But then some of these ones who survived the siege will become Christians sometime later. In other words, it's because they've been chosen by God, not just before the siege, but before the foundation of the world, as Paul says in Ephesians 1:4, that God will preserve their lives long enough to hear the gospel and believe it. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short, Jesus says. What a comfort that should be for us. That should be an incredible comfort for us. Nothing, not even a great tribulation, can lay a hand on God's people in a way that goes against God's purposes. God's power trumps any trouble. Any trouble. But here we should add that this is a word and a designation that will also be used in a much broader sense as well, because we know this same word is going to be applied by the Apostle Paul to God's people among the Gentiles too, to God's people from all nations that the disciples will soon go to, as we saw last week. And so, as R.T. France puts it, the elect are the people who belong to the Son of Man. The boast of Israel to be God's chosen people is now being applied not to the nation as a whole, but to those from among Israel and from the ends of the earth who will constitute the new messianic community. In other words, it's a designation applied to all of those everywhere from all time, he's saying, who will look to Jesus in faith as their Savior and as their King. So if you are a Christian, that is describing you as well. Today in our text, Jesus speaks about three events his disciples can't miss. First event they can't miss is that devastating pollution is coming. The second event they can't miss is that great tribulation is coming. And now the third event Jesus says they can't miss is that the Son of Man is coming. The Son of Man is coming. Look now at verses 23 through 28. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Here again, Jesus warns the disciples about false prophets. I mean, he's already done this before earlier in the chapter. He's doing it again. False prophets, false Christs who will come. But why would such imposters rise up at a time like this when Jerusalem was under such tribulation? I mean, you know, you would think, wouldn't you hope, wouldn't you think that a common enemy would bind the city together under one cause? I mean, that's what the movies do, right? Common enemy, common cause. Well, you would hope that that would happen. But we know all too well, I think, in our own day, that just as hard times bring out the heroes, they also bring out the villains as well. Don't they? It tends to be during disasters and catastrophes, even today, that the greatest frauds are committed during those catastrophes. People posing as aid workers or relief workers or good Samaritans or insurance companies, they swoop in, don't they? And they prey on the most vulnerable, right in the middle of catastrophes. And the same will happen in Judea during this time of tribulation, Jesus says. But why might this especially be the case for the Jews in Judea and in Jerusalem in particular? Well, because the Jews have a history, don't they? They have a history, and these imposters know it. They know all the Bible stories about the miraculous deliverances of Jerusalem in the past. They know the story of King Jehoshaphat, who decided to ask the Lord what to do when he heard that a vastly superior army was coming their way. They know how the Lord fought for them, causing the invading armies to destroy themselves before Israel's army ever got to the battlefield. They know the story of King Hezekiah, who spread the threatening letter from Sennacherib before the Lord when the armies of Syria surrounded the walls of Jerusalem. They know how the angel of the Lord responded by killing 180,000 enemy soldiers that very night, again, fighting for them. And they also know all the stories and all the prophecies about the greatest king of all, the coming promised king who is the Christ. They know all the prophecies about how that king will put all the enemies of God under his feet once and for all. And they know how irresistible that hope will be at a time like this. And of course, that king has already come in the person of Jesus, and they've missed him. But now they will hijack the name of God's anointed one, God's Christ, in order to lead the besieged people astray, in order to pursue their own selfish purposes. One commentator suggested that a man named Simon Bar-Gioria one of the main zealot leaders of the revolt against Rome, was one of these possible false Christs who rose up that Jesus is referring to. Josephus says, during the siege, he became regarded as a king by many of the people. And the Romans seemed to take this at face value, because he wasn't killed in Jerusalem at the siege. He was captured, and he was taken back to Rome. He was paraded through the streets before being executed as, quote, the enemy's general and king. And Jesus says it will be even more easy to be led astray by these imposters, because some of them will perform great signs and wonders, he says. Well, I mean, man, that seems difficult to believe. Did things like that happen during the siege? Again, Josephus seems to confirm that there were a series of signs and wonders that occurred at the time before the city was destroyed. He lists such things as the parting of the Jordan, the collapse of one part of the city walls. That doesn't sound like a miracle to me. The uncovering of Moses' sacred vessels. I don't know what that means. And other things. Were these real, these things? I mean, were they counterfeit miracles? Were they illusions? I don't know. But my guess is that the greater the desperation, the less people will demand convincing proof, is my guess. Whatever these signs or wonders look like, they must have been sufficiently convincing. Because Jesus says that if it wasn't for the fact that the elect are protected by God, they would have been led astray too. That's the sense of the wording, if possible, even the elect. He says, false Christs and false prophets will arise, and they'll perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. It's a way of saying it's not possible for them to be led astray, but only because they've been chosen by God. They're being protected by God. Apart from that, in other words, even they would have been deceived. And so even now, even through these words of warning, Jesus is already building in safety nets to those who are listening to his words and to those who are reading this Gospel of Matthew, which was written before the destruction of the temple as well. Jesus is building in safety nets. See, he says, I have told you beforehand. He's putting them on alert. Once again, what a comfort that should be for us, that nothing, not even great deception, can lay its hand on God's people in a way that goes against God's purposes. God's power trumps every lie. Every lie. Look now at verse 26. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. You've been warned, Jesus is saying here. This isn't how I'm going to come back. This isn't how the parousia, this isn't how my second advent is going to go down. So don't be fooled, he's saying, by the same kind of tactics that every false Messiah and every false Christ and every false teacher always uses. Well, tactics like what? Tactics like only being willing to give evidence for their claims far away from public scrutiny, right? First, Jesus anticipates a claim that the Christ has come back and is now in the wilderness. He anticipates a claim like that. This is, you know, and it makes sense. Why would a claim like that be made? Well, that's both the kind of place a Jew might expect to find a prophet. Think of John the Baptist. Where'd he show up? The wilderness. So that's the kind of place a Jew would expect a prophet to show up. But it's also the kind of place far away from prying eyes, right? Far away from prying eyes. And so if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. Second, Jesus anticipates a claim that the Christ has come back and is in some secret room somewhere. He's behind closed doors. That's where he is, right? It's the kind of place you might need special credentials to be allowed into. It's the kind of place you might have to pay money to be allowed to go into. But Jesus is saying they won't have to be that kind of insider to know if the parousia has taken place. And so if they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it, Jesus says. Those should be red flags for you, Jesus is saying. These should make alarm bells go off in your ears, Jesus is saying. These should make you very suspicious. Why? Because the third event Jesus says they can't miss is that the Son of Man is coming. He says they can't miss it. You don't have to go on a pilgrimage somewhere. You don't have to pay money or do the special secret handshake to get in to see me. You will know it. It's going to be public. Look now at verse 27 and 28, where he backs this up. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Verse 28, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Here I think Jesus is giving them two vivid pictures to illustrate the fact that they won't be able to miss his return when he comes. That you won't be able to miss his return when he comes. Two vivid pictures that communicate that his parousia will be public, it will not be private, that his coming will be unmissable. Unmissable. The first is the picture of how lightning appears in the sky. You know, when I was a kid, my bedroom was, our house was built on the top of a hill. We could see a waterfall. We had rainforest all around us. My bed was right by my window, and at night, I would, when the rainy season, when the thunderstorms would roll down through our valley every night, lightning would just flash constantly for 2 or 3 hours, and I couldn't get to sleep. I'd sit there with the, you know, with the window shade over my head, and I'd be looking out, just watching the whole jungle illuminate as bright as day from the east to the west. And that's how unmissable Christ's coming is going to be, Jesus says. It's going to be as hard to keep secret and hidden as a flash of lightning. Get it? Yeah. As the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. The second vivid picture is that of vultures who've spotted the corpse. Now, this word for bird in all openness can also be translated eagles, but context matters. Eagles don't eat corpses, so carrion. So most Bibles translate this vultures. So the second vivid picture is that of vultures who've spotted a corpse. And again, there are probably hundreds of ways of interpreting this saying, but honestly, I just think the most straightforward interpretation is in keeping with Jesus' words that his coming will be unmissable. You won't be able to miss it. And so in this case, it will be as unmissable as the location of a corpse when vultures are circling. Have you ever seen vultures circling? You know there's something dead there. You can't miss it. You can see them for miles. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And so if the prediction here is that the third event the disciples can't miss is the coming of the Son of Man, the application for the disciples and all those in Judea is this: wait with constancy. Wait with constancy. What's that? Constancy just means the quality of being faithful and dependable. It's the quality of being enduring and unchanging as one waits. And it's an application all Christians, all disciples of Jesus, can take to heart as we wait for his second coming. Yes, we too, all of us, we should flee with urgency from anything that defiles us or is seen as filthy in the sight of God. And yes, we too should pray with fervency whenever we see trouble coming for us or coming for others. But finally, especially, we need to be disciples like these ones in our text today who will wait with constancy for the coming of our King. Which means this, that we don't get sidelined by our sins that so easily entangle, that we don't get weighed down by trouble that makes us afraid, and that we don't get distracted by the next shiny leader or craze or fad in the Christian world that comes along, but that instead, with our hand to the plow, we continue to make disciples of all nations as we wait with eyes fixed on Jesus.